Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and welcome to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. Today, we are delighted to have a guest with us, James McCormick. Richard.
Yes, I'm very delighted that James is joining us. I've been a huge fan of his for 10 years at least. He's done so much work trying to untangle the issues that EBM pretends to present to us in clear-cut ways, but which are actually very complex if you're trying to deal with patients in primary care. And today, I think we're not going to have his songs or his riffs. And he's got his own series of podcasts that you can listen to, so you don't have to hear me drone on. But we thought we might try and talk together about these issues that we've already discussed in my series of podcasts, and James has already discussed in his. But it's how we get down to actually deciding what treatments to use in what order for the common conditions that we treat, partly on a preventive basis, partly on a symptomatic basis in primary care. And we've already talked about blood pressure, which of course is asymptomatic unless you're about to die. Diabetes, which can become symptomatic and can make you blind and your limbs drop off and give you cardiovascular disease if you don't control it. But what are you actually trying to control? And then another one is heart failure, where you are symptomatic by definition. And you are likely to die from that or an associated condition. And you're on this whole list of drugs, which all have an evidence base, but we know that evidence-based medicine works best for simple binary choices where you can give one set of patients whom you've selected, perhaps not from a typical population, and you've tried it out for a year or two or as long as it takes, but never for a lifetime. And you've decided that this has such a particular degree of benefit. And we've been over these issues. And now I'd love to bring James in to hear how he sees the problem, and then we'll discuss a few examples.
Yeah, no, thanks. And thanks for inviting me, guys. It's an honor to be your first guest. So it's kind of fun to be that. And just so people, in case people don't know me, I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And as Richard said, I've been sort of disseminating or attempting to disseminate evidence information for decades. And it all came about because I remember I was taught something very, very clearly that I should be doing in my practice. And then I, even before evidence-based medicine was a term, I went and looked up the paper that was supposedly supporting it. And it was, and I didn't really know how to look at papers at the time. And I looked at it and I went, that's a terrible paper. And it turned out to be the best one that there was. And I went, wow, if really competent, good, nice people have taught me to do this, where did it go wrong? And I think exactly it was what you're talking about, Richard, is we have lots of really good evidence that we can use. But the definition of evidence-based medicine or evidence-based practice, which I think I prefer, is it's you need to know the evidence, but there's the values of the patients and the preferences and, you know, clinical expertise or experience. And I think we get too caught up on the evidence and we forget to talk about those last two because it's the evidence is the evidence. The how to do it is the most important part, and it's why clinicians are so important. And I think you guys would probably agree with that.
I'm delighted to hear that you don't think we'll be replaced by computers anytime soon.
Well, we I had a fun thing that I did. We're doing a course this year, and I asked ChatGPT to provide what does evidence-based medicine mean, but do it in a Shakespearean prose. It was fascinatingly good.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so you, I'm a bit more hesitant that we're not going to be replaced, but it's that nuance of, because correct me if I'm wrong, guys, I'm sure you know this. I have rarely ever seen a person who was a patient who was actually in the clinical trial. You know,
Yes.
so we're talking about people who we are extrapolating to, and that's the nuance that we're talking about.
Yeah, and that becomes really important because we're subjecting patients on our say-so to take drugs often for most of their lives, or at least half of their adult life, if they're discovered to have type 2 diabetes in their 40s, or if they're discovered to have high blood pressure, say, in their 30s, they are going to be on these drugs, and we are trying to guide them through it. And at the moment, what often happens is that the evidence from one trial becomes superimposed on the next because a treatment has already become standard and it becomes unethical not to offer it to a patient. And so you add the next agent on and you will get a bit of an incremental benefit from that. Or you may compare the two in some cases. And then a new agent comes along, which seems an awful lot better than the ones that have gone before, but you don't take patients off the ones that have gone before. And so you get this kind of geological buildup from the substratum up to the next and then up to the latest. And this is not really how I would like medicine to be done, and yet it's the way that we do it because that's the easiest way to build guidelines. So I'd just like some ideas about that from you, James, and perhaps that we can get past that.
Well, you're talking about the individualization of medicines, really, because you know there are and I think you guys have talked about high blood pressure before, and I think that it's a really useful sort of analogy, because we will never know if anyone benefits from treating high blood pressure or diabetes, because in general they are asymptomatic. So it's, you know, the great line is it's very difficult to make an asymptomatic patient feel better. And I think, you know, so we're really talking about reducing their risk. And when we talk about that, and we can, you know, there's always a debate. What's the right blood pressure number you should get to? You know, should, do statins actually work? Is it about the lipids? But let's assume that all of these things do work. Let's go with that sort of premise. So then it's all about a discussion of how big a benefit, because, you know, if there was a guarantee that you would, if I took this one pill and it guaranteed that I would never have a heart attack or a stroke, and it caused no side effects, and it didn't cost anything, I think most people would want it. I think you guys would take it. I think Richard would take it.
Yes, I think I would. I've always taken a highly skeptical view, but in fact, when it comes down to it, if I treat myself and treat others, then I take a much more lenient view. And if people want to live longer, well, they should have that opportunity. I wouldn't deny that's the case on a population level with blood pressure lowering and with lipid lowering through statins and through these more recent genetically active drugs. So I think we can move beyond that and say, let's say you definitely, if your blood pressure is above a certain level, and we won't debate which, you want to start an agent. But which agent do you start?
Well, yeah, the nuance though is we know not everyone benefits, and we actually know the vast majority don't.
Yes.
So let's put some sort of numbers to it. As you know, the very first hypertension trial was done back in 1967. And I think you were, you know, I was, that made me 8 at the time. And their average, as you guys know, I'm sure it was the first VA trial, their average blood pressures were like 190 over 120. And they only treated people for 18 months. But the absolute benefits were in the were in the 5 to 10% range. You know, you don't even have to do statistics on this study, because if you didn't treat it, the outcomes of there were death and strokes and all that stuff. But even with blood pressures like that for 18 months, the risk of death was only, and I'm only is a word I'm sort of using, it's 6% is still high, it was only 6%. And heart attacks and strokes were only in the 2 to 3% range. And that's with blood pressures of 190 over 120. But treating those people almost eliminated that risk over 18 months. So that's, you know, so in that case, I think if the drug didn't cause any side effects and it was didn't cost much money, that to me would be a very good treatment. But even with those big number blood pressure numbers, you can still see that, you know, not everybody has a heart attack or a stroke right away. And it's really important. My entire messaging, I think, over my career is, let's talk about if we did treat you. Let me rephrase that. If we don't treat you, what is your chance of having a bad outcome? And if we do treat you, and then we can discuss the side effects and the cost and the inconvenience, and then make a decision. So I think that's the framework. And so all we need are the tools to be able to give people ballpark estimates of the potential benefits, the potential harms. And I always start off by saying there are always harms, especially with things like blood pressure. So it's going to be side effects, inconvenience, cost, measurements, all those sorts of things. So we are guaranteed harm when we go down this path. So then we have to figure out, is that harm worth the benefit? And the only person who can really make that decision, I think, is the person who's taking it. Because I'm sure you've had this, Richard or Raj, you've had this, where you explain the benefits and harms of things to people. And you say, well, the benefit is 1%. You know, an absolute 1% difference, let's say, or 2%. And some people go, ooh, that's a lot. And people go, ooh, that's not much. And I've even talked to people who, you know, the absolute benefit would be 10% over the next 4 or 5 years. And they go, well, that's not much. You know, and you cannot predict that. And I think there are ample tools that allow us to give ballpark estimates. And if we get away from saying, well, you know, it's the evil drug companies or it's the evil specialists or the evil guideline writers that are forcing us to do this, we as healthcare providers have access to the evidence. I'll give you, you know, people say, well, there's evidence that's being hidden. I am unaware of a single large cardiovascular trial that has not been published. One of them has been published.
I think you've made lots of valuable points there, James. And of course, you've made lots of valuable tools. In fact, I think you've made some of the best.
Well, thank you.
I was praising Julian Treadwell's GP evidence site the other day, and I still think it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
But it's based on NICE guidelines, and I think if a GP really is interested in this, and we'll come on to that question whether GPs really are interested in these things, I think they do well to look at both. And every patient, well, we're not even talking about patients in the case of people with high blood pressure. They are just physiologically at one end of a distribution curve, and they are, like everyone, at risk of death at some point in their lives and various events, as we all are. And it's just a question of their philosophy, as you said, as to whether to take medication to change that and to lower certain risks at the cost of these harms, which in the case of most blood pressure medications these days are not very, very considerable. Whereas when those early trials were done, some of the drugs were absolutely terrible. Reserpine made people terribly depressed. Alpha-methyl-DOPA was awful. They were using far too high doses of thiazide diuretic. Yeah. People were peeing all day. Nowadays, it's much easier.
Although I would suggest that all of those drugs, you know, a drug is only is toxic dependent on its dose.
Yes.
You know, and I think all of those medications that you just mentioned, we can use all of them, including, I mean, up until a little while ago, a very good colleague, friend of mine, used reserpine, but he used very small doses. And you can get away with doing that. And I think there's the nuance of how do we take what goes on in clinical trials where, you know, they give this dose or they give that dose. We don't know how a person will respond. So I think when it comes to any of these things, so blood pressure is a great example, is how do you Let's say you go through the thing and you, the best evidence, say, here's your risk of a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years, ballpark. Here's the benefit. If a person goes, that seems like a reasonable, I wouldn't mind that benefit. Now the issue is, there is no way to know whether that person will have a side effect, right? That's the problem. If we knew that the person would not tolerate it, we would never start the medication, but we can never know that. But you're right, Richard. I would think you'd also have to agree that the majority, and we can put numbers to this later on, but the majority of people will tolerate things like statins and blood pressure medications. So the problem is not everybody does. And so the only way to really figure that out is let's say the person wants to start a medication, you start with a very low dose and we'll work our way up, and there's no hurry. And I think if we can prevent any side effects, and I think you can by, in most cases, starting with low doses, then you get all of the benefit, very minimal harm. And as you guys know very well, if you start with much lower doses, the cost is always less, you know, because you can split the tablets and do all that sort of stuff. But you're never going to find a clinical trial that tells you to do that, because you don't, there's no such thing as a trial that would look at that sort of process. So I think both of you guys would agree would be to say, we have these very effective treatments, but we just use them wrong.
Raj?
So I there's a couple of things I want to circle back to. I'll first start with the first point made, which I think is a great one, which is that, you know, we assume these things work and it's so important to individualize it. And I have to agree that I think, you know, we can never predict what the adverse effects are, who's going to happen with, just like we can't predict who's going to benefit. So the idea of using them in the shared decision-making model, and then having the sense of, you know, starting low, making sure there's no adverse effects, and titrating to the point where, hey, if you have the benefit, we can stop it there, is great. And I think we have trials in blood pressure, especially showing like multiple low-dose medications have great benefit and less side effect profiles and maximizing single-agent drugs and so on. One thing that I thought was really interesting, James, is that, you know, you oftentimes are very critical of studies in medicine, but you don't really strike me in this conversation so far as being really a huge skeptic or nihilist. You're actually taking a very much of a pro-intervention with a lot of these drugs, assuming their effect. So I think it's a very interesting balance that you have. And, well, you know, how do you balance that when you talk with others?
Well, so the way I'm going, so because here's where everybody will debate. What I'm trying to do is get away from the debate about, do the drugs work?
I see.
Because how do we define whether they work or not? Because if we give a blood pressure medication and it reduces the absolute risk of a heart attack by 2%, does that mean it works? Well, no, it works in 2% of people. So what I'm trying to sort of get across is, let's assume these things work. So let's say, and we can absolutely go back and debate the quality of the study and all that sort of stuff,
yes,
for sure. But the issue is, let's assume they work as well as people are saying. So as well as the guideline people say, let's assume that's the case, because you're absolutely right. We can go back and debate, you can pretty much, there's not a study that, people will say there's not a single study that has shown anything. But let's get off of that. So the question is then, how do we do that for individual people?
Right.
And how do we treat that? And you're exactly right. I think, you know, two or three low doses of medications are far superior to a big dose of something, because the evidence is outstandingly clear that doubling the dose of a medication almost never does anything. It's always the very low doses. And Richard, you know as full well as I do, when back, 30 or 40 years ago or even longer, the doses we were using were ridiculously high.
Yes.
And we caused all sorts of side effects because of that. And that's because there's a flawed approval process. You have to show your drug works. To show a drug works, you have to actually use doses that almost everybody will respond to. So the entire approval process is flawed, and it's not the fault of anybody. It's just the fault of the fact we have to show it works. And then you have to recommend the doses that were used. But that's where we as clinicians, although I don't see patients anymore. I know you don't, Richard, but Raj is going to see all the patients for us as we could possibly need, is then individualizing that approach. And We'll never know if people benefit from their blood pressure medications, but we can identify if they don't tolerate them or if they can't afford them and that sort of stuff. So I think we need informed healthcare providers to know the benefit of, because Raja, if you thought everybody, and I'm not saying you do, if you thought everybody benefits from the treatment of high blood pressure, you would push and try to get everybody on them and even say you've got to tolerate some side effects. But we know it, but if you know it's a 1 or 2 or 3% benefit, you and I'm using you as the yes. example, would have a different approach to it, because you would probably then find that that side effects and inconvenience are they're just inappropriate. Yeah.
So I have a follow up question. I think I understand this point, but I think it's worth clarifying. And this is a little philosophical and esoteric. You've made the point a few times, like when you give a medicine, even though we know that it benefits 2 or 10%, we don't really know if it works for a person or not. Can you kind of delve into what you mean by that a little bit?
Yeah, well, because you can't, you know, so there's two thoughts. And Richard, you talked about this earlier on. There's two things that we do with medications. We give them to reduce the risk of something. So preventative medicines, you know, for blood pressure, lipids and glucose and all that sort of stuff. We will never know if a person benefits. We'll know that if it lowers their risk factor, but right. we know very clearly that just because you lower a risk factor doesn't mean you get a benefit. So the only way you can know that you get a benefit is to look at the results of clinical trials that show a reduction in important clinical outcomes.
Right. So we may know that a group of individuals have less events, but we won't know which specific individuals are the ones that are better off.
Yeah. Yeah. And in right. fact, and it's one of the reasons I know you guys have talked about the NNT and the term NNT is one. I don't actually like the term NNT because I think it confuses all sorts of things. I just like to tell mm-hmm. people your risk is this and we can get you down to this, because yes. I don't know what your experience has been. I've said, well, the numbers needed to treat is 50. And then patients will say, well, am I the one? You know,
Am I the one who's going to benefit? Because if I'm not, why am I doing this, doc?
Yeah, right. If we knew that you were the one who would benefit.
Right.
Boy, you know, we would not be doing this podcast. That would be, you know, so I think, so there's that process, but we can identify the harms.
Right.
But even that is tricky, right? Because many of the harms are so subtle that it's hard to pick up. Is it the drug? And, you know, the typical side effects of every medication is nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea, skin rash, and death. And so how do you pick up those sort of things? So how do you use principles to use, if we're going to say, yes, we are going to try to treat your blood pressure. And I'm not saying we should treat, you know, people who are at 130 over 70. That's irrelevant. We can give a ballpark idea of what the benefit is, and then we can talk about it. But how do we do it safely? And how do we prevent the problem that Richard's talked about, where we just keep adding and adding and adding and adding and adding and never subtracting? So, you know, I think the best way to do it is from a preventative stuff is to know the evidence of the size of the benefit and then individualize it using very low doses and working your way and always telling the patient, let's reevaluate. But you guys know that does take time, right? It's much easier just to say you're high, you know, you have your blood pressure is high, you need to be treated.
I think this is the biggest problem, actually. I think it's doctor behavior. I think we've got a good scientific basis for actually arguing that blood pressure lowering agents shouldn't be added on, but should be tested sequentially after proper measurement. And we've even lost track of what proper measurement is. Mm-hmm. We knew what it was with a mercury sphygmomanometer manometer. We don't know that the machines used by patients, even the ambulatory ones and so forth, are all that well calibrated, and we don't quite know what readings we should go on. We have a ballpark idea, though. We've got enough, really, to be going on and to say, if we were doing this properly for people who are making lifelong decisions, we would make sure that we were monitoring blood pressure at home and in the office, and we would use a small dose of one agent. And if that didn't seem to be giving a big enough effect, rather than going straight on to adding a second agent, we might try a different group. And there are some trials that support this, though they're not very big. And the trouble is that there is really no interest on the part of drug companies or indeed government agencies to do this kind of thing, because what we do kind of works for most of the time. And doctors who are very busy rather like the idea that if someone comes in for a blood pressure check, they can just do the blood pressure and make a quick decision and then see them again in 6 months or whatever. I think if we were taking it terribly seriously on a population level, we'd be doing it quite differently. But I think we have to see this in the context of social conditions in Canada, in the US, and in the UK, where health is not actually prioritized in that way. It's seen extractively by a lot of people for how much money they can get out of it and not how best to support patients and primary care physicians. We tend to be a little bit left behind in that. Yeah. So that's my little political point. The practical point is that, you know, what are we to do in an ideal world, which we're not in? How would we go about this? What trials would we be doing? And I think that's probably all we're going to have time for in this podcast, because I don't want to wear out the listeners too much. So, if with Raj's permission, shall we go on to that topic now about how we might go about looking into these things more carefully?
Yeah, well, I think you know, the group that I work with, when it comes to guidelines, you know, we got so frustrated with the national guidelines, and I know you guys have talked about this, because they sort of tend to pay lip service to values and preferences of patients and all that sort of stuff. And so we've developed, all of our guidelines are called simplified guidelines. And you know why we do that? Because we know that primary care clinicians are overwhelmed with the amount of work that they have to do to try and get these things done. So we are very evidence-based, but we focus on making it simple. And we're just finishing up our redo of our simplified lipid guidelines. And it's really simple. The evidence is really clear that statins have an effect. I don't think anyone can definitively say that you need to get to a certain cholesterol level. I don't even know if one can make an argument that you need to get to a specific blood pressure level. I think what we should be doing is using medications that have proven evidence that they reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes. And if we're going to make the lives of patients and healthcare providers a little bit easier, we can back way off on all of these unnecessary measurements. Because, you know, Richard and Raj, you guys know as well as I do, blood pressure medications individually lower blood pressure on average by about systolic by about 5 to 6 millimeters of mercury. You guys can't pick that up in your practice. So it is really, really difficult for you to be able to pick up whether the drug is actually lowering the blood pressure. And so I think, you know, you can make an argument. We certainly make the argument for lipids. And the nice thing about that is that it makes it much easier. It's just, you take a pill, if you tolerate it and you can afford it and all that, you don't have to worry about all these repeat measurements and so on. And I think we could almost do that with blood pressure. And I think one of the most important reasons to measure blood pressure when they're on a pill is to make sure that their blood pressure is not too low. You know, so yeah, that we can reduce the risk of, because the nice thing about cholesterol lowering drugs is no one really collapses from hypocholesterolemia.
Yes.
Right. So I can't tell you how little I care about statins. I do worry about drugs for diabetes and blood pressure, because people fall down when their blood pressure is zero or their glucose is zero. And so it's those ones where we really, really need to, you know, start with very low doses and work our way up. And I think if you start with the best way to treat blood pressure is to start with the least expensive agent that has decent evidence. And we have lots of those. And whether it be an ACE inhibitor or a thiazide. I don't know the right one. I don't think anybody knows the right one. But you, Richard, you know, in your practice, and for years and years, there's huge debates. Is it beta blockers or ACE inhibitors or blah, 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 blah. And it was all sort of, and I got to be careful what way I say it, it's all mental masturbation. You know, we really know, we have decent evidence for about three or four different classes of high blood pressure medications. So if they're all relatively equally effective, then it's very simple. It comes down to what are the risk of side effects and the cost. And I think that's how I think about it almost always comes down to cost. So you choose the least expensive and the ones that have been around the longest, because at least there's probably no hidden side effects that are all of a sudden going to pop up.
Yeah, I'd agree with that as a basis for practice right now. I think we could probably do better in the future if we were to examine the characteristics of patients who respond to particular agents. And there may even be in-class differences. The atenolol trial showed that. And we had some interesting correspondence from Neil Maskery, who I might invite on as well.
Because he's great. You should. He's great.
He is great, and he was pointing out that there have been trials where there have been crossovers of drugs and people have responded much more to one particular type than another. And
I was going to, the responding is blood pressure, and now we're going down the path of surrogate markers, right? So it's really tricky because, you know, if you go down the blood pressure thing, you have to assume that that it's working because it lowers blood pressure. But we know, you brought up atenolol. Atenolol is a very effective medication for lowering blood pressure. There are five large randomized controlled trials showing it does nothing to cardiovascular disease.
Yes. And, you know, we are even depressing ourselves with the complexity of this. So I don't know what we're doing for our listeners.
Well, no, I think it's not that complex because I think, I think we could comfortably say, so let's say it's blood pressure. There are absolutely tools that show you give you a ballpark, what's your risk if you don't treat and what to treat if you do treat. And then we have the nice thing, we have four or five different agents. They're likely all equally effective, but we don't know how people are going to tolerate them. And you'll never know until you try. So you just start with very low doses of the least expensive ones and then work your way up. And I agree with you, Richard. I think if the first one doesn't work, or certainly if it's not tolerated, you just stop it. You don't keep going.
Great. Well, you've come up with some clear and almost optimistic messages there that apply
wonderful.
To real life,
yes.
Which is exactly what we're looking for here, because we could talk endlessly about the complexities and the things that we don't know about this, but we do know those things. We'll probably never know which of the 100 patients we put on blood pressure medication will avoid a stroke, and perhaps two of them over 10 years or whatever. That comes with the territory. And I think we're agreed that pre-hypertension and the constant urge to treat more and more of the population are ideas that, are not shared by us. But
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah. So, Raj, how would you sum up this discussion?
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think I want to just say there's a wonderful big picture aspect to what I'm hearing from James, because, I mean, it sounds like from someone who's been teaching EBM for decades, you really understand the heart of challenges what we have in primary care, which is we're just overwhelmed. We're dealing with a lot. We're not always sure of all the information available. And I think to be more effective evidence-based practitioners, having simplified evidence-based ideas, straightforward information on what works, what doesn't, and then keeping in mind, you know, this idea of what is that magnitude, what are the patient preferences, introducing that nuance and not kind of overwhelming us is super important. And I really like how you've highlighted that we want to be careful we're not chasing targets and really keep in mind the patient's risks and balancing that out. And so that's just a wonderful recap. Then it has a sense of optimism. I actually wanted to ask you in summary, James, like, what do you see as the major challenges and growth for EBM and primary care going forward?
Well, do we have another 3 hours? That's part of. But I think here's my experience with this, and I'm much way removed from practice from all of this sort of stuff. But I think maybe you guys can help me work on this one. I believe that not everybody's going to buy into this concept, so we have to realize that that's just not going to happen. But in my experience, especially in primary care, I have seen so many sort of people who are sort of in their 35s to 40 who are kind of sick to death of what they're doing. But I have talked to lots of people that when you say, why don't we change how you do it? Rather than just blindly trying to follow guidelines and ordering lab tests and doing all that sort of stuff, why don't you think about engaging patients in the discussion process? And I can't tell you how many clinicians have come back to me later on and said, I actually enjoy my practice more because I'm not so focused in on getting targets and worrying about this. I'm just having conversations. And one of our mottos that we have with our group is that we don't care. And that's not really a good model for healthcare. You shouldn't care whether a person takes a statin. You shouldn't care necessarily whether they treat their blood pressure. You should care that you've informed them well and helped them make a decision. And because I think it's something that needs to be done that way. And I think it makes for a more enjoyable practice if you do it that way. And I'd actually like to hear from you. Would you not agree, Raj and Richard, that doing it that way, that's where the enjoyment of the practice comes. And it's the value. Anybody can say, you must treat your blood pressure, you must do this. That's anyone can read a guideline. But the fun part of healthcare are those discussions. And I think you guys would agree, right?
I love you, James. That was perfectly put. I've been collecting people who share that view now for about 15 years, which is how Raj got collected. And I'll be seeing Victor Montori in a couple of nights' time, and he'll absolutely agree with you. And I think all good physicians will agree with you because there's nothing more stultifying than trying to make a patient into an object and treat them as some kind of population figure in derived from randomized trial evidence, and whereas everything that helps us grow as people and helps us practice better as professionals comes from this interaction and treating them as equals or perhaps more than equals in what's going to be a lifelong decision for them. So on that note, I think we should end because that is the note that I always want to end on. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah, it was great, great fun. I appreciate you inviting me. So hopefully that was okay for you guys.